The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they
main
are
engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday afternoon, June 6th Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you for tuning in on this very historical day, because this is D-Day, and hopefully those of you who are too young to know what that is, you go look it up and pay tribute to a very special day in history that really is also very, very important. And we certainly appreciate those that are still around that served on this day, and those that are no longer with us as a result of this day. But a very important day and a great day to be doing a space show. Great day for freedom. And we have a terrific program planned for you today, so let me rush through the announcements so we can get right to the program. Those of you who would like to call us and talk with our guest, who I'll introduce in just a minute, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air and get you going on the show as quickly as possible. And if you are unable to use the phone for whatever reason and you want to use email, the address to use is drspace@thespaceshow.com. That's also our website. So do check out our homepage. So we do have a website newsletter there that has more information in it than on the email newsletter. And it also, if you scroll down, has all of the upcoming shows. And as you see, we're booking shows starting into August already. So that is on the website newsletter. Also, there's a part of the website on the far right side. If you scroll down, you will see upcoming shows. Well, those are the shows for the coming week, the week that we're now involved with. And once a program is listed there, you are free to start posting comments on it. And if you do comment before the show is archived, I will read the comments on air when the show is live. Otherwise, there'll be archived comments, as that is our blog. So feel free to use it before a program starts or as soon as that program appears in the upcoming show menu bar. If you scroll down just a little bit more, you'll see our announcement blog. This is our old Space Show blog, and now we use it for special announcements. So if something isn't right with the Space Show, you're not hearing the show you intended to hear, or you're not hearing anything, do check it, because I probably have made an announcement about it, like I did a couple of weeks ago when we were without power, where I am all day Sunday, but I was able to get in through my cell phone and post a comment that there was no power and our Sunday programming was canceled. So do get in the habit of using the announcement blog when there's something going on, or if you want to see if we posted a message about something. Also on our website, all of our programs are archived, and you can easily listen right off of the website or easily download those shows. We do have a store, and it is up in the support menu, but Cafe Press, which sponsors our store, is on the blitz. And if you can believe it, they do acknowledge that they're on the blitz, but they have no idea how to fix the problem or when to fix it. This is not a good sign. If any of you out there have any experience with other online logoware stores for websites, and you can offer a suggestion to us to replace Cafe Press, I am all ears. So please email it to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember also that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're able to bring you these programs because many of you do donate and support us. As a 501c3, you do get a tax deduction for your federal taxes, assuming you pay federal taxes. The same is true for California, as we're a California public benefit corporation. You'll see the PayPal links both on the Space Show website and OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website. And also you can support us through your Amazon purchases. And if you click on the Amazon link on the homepage, there are two programs that Amazon offers for nonprofits that you can use. If you're a habitual Amazon user like I am, it does mount up, and we appreciate Amazon donating a portion of every purchase to the Space Show. So it's a good way to support us while at the same time buying your favorite products off of Amazon. And we are trademarked and copyrighted, and we do encourage you to share our programming with people. A show is typically 25 megabytes, so they're a little bit large to send via email, although you can do it. Or just send people the URL to the show. There are a couple of rules that go along with the freedom we have in distributing our programs. One of them is not to do anything commercial with the program. The other, which is the big one, is to not edit the programs and then put cuts or clips up on YouTube or any other website, including your own website. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Please read our entire copyright statement at the bottom of every spaceshow.com website page, as well as OneGiantLeapFoundation.org page. If you have any questions, or if you're just absolutely dying to edit a Space Show program and put some cut up on your website or someplace else, please contact me by email and see if we can work it out and you can get permission. And I really appreciate that. And someone did that from London with a recent program that they were on today. And I gave them permission right away to do what they wanted to do. So it is possible, but it's always better to ask. And we do appreciate that. We do have sponsors, and their banner ads go across our homepage. And I would urge you from time to time to pay attention to what our sponsors are saying and click on their banner ads. But the first half of our Space Show program today has two sponsors, Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, and they are the premier partner that you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we're also brought to you by Integrated Space Analytics. They had a big presentation at ISDC, for those of you that were in Puerto Rico for that event. But the Integrated Space Plan is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. And their website, where all of this is located, is thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And you can get involved in discussions, regular updates at their website, interactive features, and you can also buy your own copy of the Integrated Space Plan poster. It comes in two different sizes. So check them out, thespaceplan.com. And that brings me to our guest today. So Gary Olson is back with us. First of all, he has a terrific article, which we're talking about today, in a recent issue of the Space Review, dated back to May 16th. The title of the article is The Effects of Changing Economics on Space Architecture and Engineering. I did put the URL in the newsletters, both the website newsletter and the email newsletter, for you to go get this article. But again, it's dated Monday, May 16th of this year, Effects of Changing Economics on Space Architecture and Engineering. Gary is a senior engineer in the space systems sector of TASC, T-A-S-C, an engineering company, which is a leading provider of engineering solutions and technical services for the government. He writes frequently on space engineering, policy and strategy, and especially the commercial development of space. He has more than 30 years of diverse experience in space systems, engineering, and strategy, and previously worked for the Jet Propulsion Lab and the Department of Energy. He's a graduate of Princeton with an MS from MIT. He is a recipient of the Space Station Freedom Award of Merit from NASA and the Space Pioneer Award from the National Space Society. He's also a member of the Board of Directors of the Space Frontier Foundation and Alliance for Space Development. And he was a guest in our Hotel Mars segment on this subject about 2 weeks ago. Gary, welcome to the full Space Show program. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure and honor to talk to you again. How are economics changing, and what is the, I mean, your title is catchy, Economics Are Changing with Space Architecture and Engineering, but is the change coming around about because of the growth in the commercial and the new space industry, or is it just sort of an evolution that typically happens over time with space growth and space economics? What's behind the changes and how it's changing architecture and engineering requirements?
I believe that the changes are from the development of what we call new space, the new commercial developments, and they're driven initially, I believe, by the economic and technical developments that have permitted lower costs. The lower costs enable space enterprises both to extend their sales into markets that they already have and also to open up new markets entirely.
Where are the lower costs coming from? Because big launch costs, I mean, SpaceX has dropped the cost, yes, but not by magnitudes yet. So what are you talking about where there's lower costs coming in? What part of the industry are you seeing the lower cost having an effect?
The first part is with the small satellites. The CubeSats and the larger small sats are significantly less expensive, in some cases several orders of magnitude less expensive than the previous large sats. And that enables things that just couldn't be done any other way.
So this is what they say will happen in the launch industry, which really hasn't happened yet. But because of lower prices, new opportunities, new businesses, new concepts, new ideas, new products are developing in the small satellite industry. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. The small sats can do things that the large sats can't do, for the simple reason that you can afford to put up so many small sats. You can essentially cover the globe. Some of the new imaging small sats are proposing, with large constellations of spacecraft, to image the entire Earth every day. No constellation of large sats could do that. And there are others that are setting up to do essentially signals intelligence from space, collecting, for example, the automatic identification system signals from ships and such. So in each instance, it's the number of small sats, particularly once they get into their preferred orbits, that will produce offerings that simply were not available before. I should add one thing to that.
Okay.
The small sats can develop much faster than the big sats. It takes a long time to design and build a large sat. Small sats can develop new designs several times a year if they're aggressive about it.
But small sats don't stay in low Earth orbit or wherever they're going for very long, and they don't have propulsion on them usually to do station keeping. So do you just keep replenishing them? Are they the ultimate in renewable space? You have to keep putting more and more of them up there?
They can go into higher orbits, and some of them will. The ones that are in lower orbits actually use their short life as a virtue. If they're in a cycle of rapid design and improvement with new generations of spacecraft coming out frequently, then after 3 or 5 years, which might be a typical decay time, the older ones are obsolete anyway. So you let them come in again, they're already replenished.
And, of course, that doesn't happen with the big satellites at all.
You couldn't afford to have it happen with the big satellites. But I have to say one thing. With the reduction in launch costs, it's true that the initial reduction in launch costs from SpaceX have been on the order of 3-to-1, which is not a full order of magnitude yet, but they're looking at getting another 30% reduction with reuse, and they're still looking to have their breakthrough product, which is the Falcon Heavy, which is dramatically more powerful and less expensive than its nearest competitors.
So is this rush to develop and launch small satellites for lots of uses, many of which we didn't even think about maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, are they going to get their own dedicated launchers, and what role does that play in helping to influence space architecture and engineering and the space part of the economy? Is that going to be a big part of it?
There are certainly quite a large number of small satellite launcher companies that are lining up to serve the small sat industry. The small satellites so far have been forced to essentially hitch rides on other launches. They either go up as secondary payloads on other launches, in which case they don't get their choice of orbit usually, or they fly up as cargo to the International Space Station and are launched from the International Space Station, in which case they also don't get their choice of orbits, unless they just happen to want that particular one. So they have a really powerful demand for dedicated launches that will put them in their correct orbits. The Planet Labs, in particular, wants to go into essentially a polar or near polar orbit, and they have not been able to get launches to that orbit very frequently.
You already have a question, and this is Elizabeth, who is in Chicago, and she said, if the big push is coming from the new space industry, are you also seeing companies that are being started and built by people who have never been in the space industry before? Is there some way to measure the number of first-time entrepreneurs leading successful space companies, and is that a factor in economic growth in the space industry?
That's a really intriguing question. I don't really know the answer to it. The people that I know all have had some contact with the space industry prior to going into the small sat business. There may be exceptions. I mean, Planet Labs, for example, started out of NASA Ames, and many of them have had prior experience either with NASA or with another company or in their university. But there could be some, particularly on the finance side and the business management side. I know that there are many people in these companies that are coming from those traditional business professions, and they have no particular need to have prior space experience.
I know when I was doing some shows with people wanting to do virtual reality in space, that many of these entrepreneurs saw space as a big potential market for them, but that isn't where they had any business experience whatsoever. So they were taking their experiences from whatever they had done before and going into virtual reality for space because they thought that might be a really big market, and it was still open, that there was still room to get in sort of on the ground floor, so to speak. So it seems to attract people from outside the industry who want to get into some of these niches that, I mean, not across the board, of course, but I think the small satellites and CubeSats has really attracted people, and virtual reality seems to as well. I don't know if that's going to be a major segment or not.
I should add that there is quite a flow, both at the worker level and, of course, at the investor level, from the software industry into the space, because so much of design of spacecraft these days is software. So that's a natural progression.
What is there about new space that produces the capability to drive and change an industry? Have you ever thought about that? What are the actual characteristics or quality of new space that makes this possible? Because it really is changing things, and traditional space was not changing things.
New space shares with traditional space the ability to look at the Earth as a whole, to look at any place on Earth. And the new space development so far has simply used the new technologies and the new cost structure to make real today what was always there as a potential. So I really see, in that sense, it's simply a deeper exploitation of what's always been there in space, which is the availability to look at the entire Earth as a whole, or to communicate with the entire Earth, because there's new developments in the communication arena as well.
Are markets opening up as a result of that, or are we primarily seeing markets in satellite communications and that's it? Are there other uses or completely different kind of markets opening up, you know, that will be part of the space economy?
There certainly are. And, for example, I think agriculture is one of the ones that's attracting more attention than many others. There's a push to have more sustainable agriculture worldwide, more intensive agriculture, and that requires information and the ability to use that information. And many of the new space imaging companies, for example, are lining up with various companies that can help them reach that market. They're those suppliers of raw data in the form of images. But they need analysis. At the front end part of the analysis, they're providing themselves. But at a certain level, they need partners that can distribute. Very recent example, Planetary Resources, whose long-term goal is to mine asteroids. In order to search for asteroids, they've developed imagers that combine hyperspectral imaging and infrared imaging, and they found that there's a market for those images if they take images of the Earth instead of taking images of space. They've now teamed up with the German company Bayer, which has a global agriculture initiative. So Bayer is helping them market to the entire world of agriculture. That's a news release within the last week or so.
This is Bayer Aspirin Company for everything, right?
I think it is the same company.
No, it is. It is the same company. So, but they're just known as Bayer, but we know it as Bayer Aspirin, right? the trade name on that. So I guess that part of the growth then is coming from new uses of imaging. So you have Earth imaging, but then you're getting new uses and new markets for that imaging, such as in agriculture, for example.
Agriculture, resource extraction, business intelligence is a very big one. Very few of these have been fully realized yet. Only two of the companies have even prototypes for their ultimate baseline systems in orbit. And those aren't in either the numbers nor the orbits that they really want. So we're talking about an industry that is just at the takeoff point. Very little of the potential has been realized yet. The explosive growth phase is still very much ahead of us.
Is this mostly driven by U.S. companies and U.S. capital and U.S. policies, or is this actually happening elsewhere, although maybe at a smaller scale?
It's definitely happening elsewhere. I would say that the United States probably has the majority of the certainly of the investment and much of the development, but other countries are very definitely involved. Canada, Germany, Italy, Israel, Japan, many others, India.
Do they have a new space component, or for them is it just general industry?
I don't really know the answer to that. I don't know how integrated their companies are with their, what you might call their traditional industry.
Interesting. I had a report yesterday on the show that Denmark is creating space regulations for commercial space, specifically in CubeSats and other small satellites. And they're creating an entire regime for how to do this in Denmark and to make this a big part of Denmark pushing forward with commercial space.
Yes, and Luxembourg has made moves to become a center for asteroid mining. And by creating a legal regime in their country, that's attractive to the industry. It's one of the things that's happened through the reduction in costs is that the barriers to entry have dropped. And what that means is it doesn't take as much money to get started. These days, you can start a space company for a lot less than $100 million. Now, $100 million sounds like a whole lot, and it is to me. But it's not a really high barrier within the investment community if you have the right value proposition. And that's really a major part of the game right now, is developing the value propositions that enable you to go out and find buyers for your product.
Ken, for those who maybe don't know what you're talking about, can you clarify a little bit about buyer propositions and what you're talking about?
Oh, certainly. Really, a value proposition comes down to what's in it for me. If I'm a farmer, I need to know that there's information that I can actually use to get better results from my farming. If I'm in the business of tracking inventory, I need to know that I'm going to be able to get information that will help track my inventory better. If I'm in retailing, I may want to count the cars in my competitor's parking lot to get an idea of how well they're doing. My competitor's probably counting the cars in my parking lot.
Is there any spillover with the new space and the small satellites going in to support national security or Department of Defense or NSA or any of those communities that really would be separate from commercial space? Are we seeing some sort of spillover effect that is helping these other segments of the space industry?
I believe so. It's, as with everything else, it's probably not very far along yet. But certainly the mating dance has certainly begun, because we've heard news reports about that happening.
Do you see any risk of any close-in market saturation, where maybe there are so many companies, so many small sat launchers may be coming online that the market capacity is not there?
I really don't see that yet. You get market saturation after an industry has gone through the explosive growth of markets. And these industries haven't begun the explosive growth yet. that would cause it to saturate. The real risk right now is a simple failure. You don't have the engineering, you don't have the financing, you don't have the market. It's the things that can go wrong in any startup endeavor. The number of companies that have gotten started in both the spacecraft and the launcher domains is actually an encouragement, because there may not be very many that survive the early die-off, not because there are too many of them, but simply because too many of them don't really get started. It can really fail at any failure point, much like flight test, and I suspect that quite a few of the companies that have declared that they're engaged won't actually show up in the end. And there is also a lot of potential market there. In the paper that I wrote, I did a thought experiment just dealing with two of the primary markets, which are agriculture and resource extraction. And resource extraction includes both mining and drilling. And those two industries together amount to $10 trillion a year of revenue. The new space industries that are addressing those industries would only need to have a market penetration of 0.1% to generate $10 billion a year of revenue to be shared across the entire industry. And that's quite a lot of revenue. That's equivalent to a major government space agency or the entire space budget for many countries.
Pretty amazing. Is there some other component adding to this growth other than satellites? What else is coming along? Is there like companies that do miniaturized electronics or something of that nature? Is that adding to this, where the CubeSat people go buy parts from them, for example? What else is happening to help drive the growth in the commercial space industry?
I'm tempted to say that everything else is happening, because the ability to buy components that will operate in space essentially off the shelf is critical to every development. And as a matter of fact, the entrepreneurs tend to avoid developing new technology completely if they can, and they do only that technology development which their business plan forces them to do. They would prefer everything to be mature technologies that they can buy off the shelf, because it reduces their costs and their risks. It's all good. They are not in love with new technology at all, unless they're forced to.
So changes in manufacturing, like 3D printing, play a role in all of this?
3D printing, new optics, new electronic circuits, anything, new mechanical developments. In anything that's developed for the regular marketplace on Earth that can be used in space, if it fulfills the function, they will see if they can use it. One of the things that happens with Earth-bound industries is that if they're successful, they ship millions of units, and those millions of units quickly become very, very reliable. And if you can use those very highly reliable units in your spacecraft, then you're that much farther ahead.
So this is sort of an endless field of what to draw on, as long as technology development is evolving and moving forward.
That is correct.
In general.
Just in general.
Just in general.
Just in general. And there's a feedback as well. Technologies that are developed specifically for space continue to feed back into other industries. It's a two-way traffic. But a lot of the traffic these days is from the general economy and into space to the benefit of space. Composites, for example, as another example.
Catherine is in Boston by email. David, I'm at work. Wish I wasn't. Can't use the telephone. My question is, are financing methods and the pool of capital keeping pace with the technology and manufacturing capabilities that are changing?
The finances appear to be there, and I'm not enough of a financial person to fully know why, but there seems to be plenty of investment capital out there right now. And one of the really interesting things I learned as I was doing this paper was that between 2012 and 2015, that the compound annual growth rate of startup investment for space was 180%. Again, over that period of 2012 to 2015. And that compares with, and that's number one in the world. It compares with 151% for Bitcoin and 150% for photo sharing. That's in percentage terms. It's relative to the size of the industry. But I think that's, it shows that there's an impressive pull to investment capital, particularly in just the last few years.
Okay, so what about the regulatory regimes? Are they keeping up? Is this turning out to be a regulated, or is it a pretty much unregulated environment for businesses and small businesses to operate?
That's another very interesting question. I don't know as much about the regulatory environment as others. I keep a something of an eye on it. I noticed that FAA that regulates launches, commercial launches, got a budget increase in the most recent budget, which they need to keep up with the traffic and applications that they're getting. So that's a good sign. One of the factors is that different countries have different regulations and they have different controls. Some countries, like the United States, have perhaps a more rigorous regulatory regime for companies that are going to image the Earth than other countries. So there's one of the things that is discussed is the appearance of perhaps flags of convenience where companies that want to do Earth imaging will shop for countries that have more friendly regulations.
And lower costs, presumably, then.
It could be lower costs, or it could be simply the ability to do the business that they want to do. You know, image at the high resolution that they want to image, for example, might be a reason to do that. But again, that's not an area of expertise for me.
Is the engineering community keeping up? Are changes happening so fast that people are overwhelmed and professions are not keeping up with it, or is everything growing sort of sympathetically?
I would say that it's very difficult to keep up with the industry at this stage. And I furthermore predict that it will get harder long before it gets easier.
And that's because changes are happening so fast?
Changes are happening so fast.
So is there a lag, or are we just not seeing the latest technology filter into designs?
I should clarify that I think that the lag is not so much with the technology, but with the growth of the new businesses. The developments in the marketplace are now moving I think, faster than the changes in the technology. The technology has been building up for decades, and now the marketplace is in a rush to exploit the trove of technology that's been built up over all those years.
So let me ask you this question. We all know that NASA has an increasing average employee age. So are NASA engineers and technical people keeping up with the changes, given that they're much older and, you know, they've been out of school for a long time, and here come all these young people that are doing these cutting-edge things and have learned them in school and have done them maybe as entrepreneurial projects even. So is NASA or are companies with an aging workforce at a disadvantage?
About that, I have no idea. I haven't really worked closely with NASA as a whole since 1993. So,
do you hear any rumors or gossip about this problem within the aerospace industry itself? Is there an aging workforce problem?
I have not heard that. I think what we have right now is an opportunity situation for young engineers and young business people and young finance people and young every other kind of profession that would contribute to a new company. Because this industry looks to be right at the beginning edge of a explosive growth phase. And we've been talking a lot about small sats, but it's not only small sats. I see possibilities for commercial space stations, for the tourism industry. There's going to be opportunities that I really can't fathom opened up by the really affordable super heavy launch. We could have an era of huge sats following on the heels of the wave of small sats. And the Falcon Heavy would be able to launch at least the mass of a main battle tank for less than $200 million. For sure, the list price is less than $100 million. And so there are very many dimensions to this. The opportunities are limited really only by people's imagination.
Was this predicted, or has it sort of crept up on people and now we realize it? Or were there people and industry organizations and think tanks that were predicting this 10 years ago?
I don't know about predicting it, but I mean, the Space Frontier Foundation has been working for this for almost 30 years.
Right.
It was almost 30 years ago that the founders realized that the vision of commercialization of space had been established along with the vision of settlement of space by the late 1980s. And the founders realized that the next wave would be starting the commercialization of space, actually doing the work of supporting the growth of an industry that did not yet exist. Now, with these huge wave of startups, you might say that the startup phase is now reaching maturity, and the next phase will be a phase of growth and sustainment and development of an increasingly lucrative industry. We may be about to enter the third phase.
I can tell you that when I wrote my commercial space dissertation at the end of the 90s and very early 2000s, none of this was talked about by any of the people that I was talking to and interviewing. I mean, you know, there were companies that were planning space tourism vehicles, but they were all single-stage-to-orbit vehicles, which, of course, never happened. And there were the companies like Teledesic that were going to do these huge cluster satellites. And, the timing was off, and that never happened. But nothing was there to suggest anything about what's been happening over the last 5 to maybe 7 years. Nothing. It's just come from out of nowhere, it seems.
It seems, but there were people that have been working. They tried one thing, and then that didn't work. And they tried something else, and that didn't work. And they tried something else again, and that worked a little bit. And they tried something else, and they hit.
Now there was one organization that I go to conferences when I can. I unfortunately haven't been in a couple of years. That has been talking about this for many, many years and pushing for it. And that was the SmallSat conference out of Logan, Utah, where they've been talking about SmallSats. And then they were sponsoring student organizations for tiny satellites known as CubeSats and wrestling with how to get the students, even at high school level, to get them up on a launch. And there were divisions in the Air Force at Kirtland and in other places that were trying to find ways to get these student payloads up there. And so that SmallSat conference and that group of people has been pushing for this for, decades as well. And I think their work is paying off big time. That conference has grown from about 450 people to 1,500 people in just a couple of years.
I actually attended that when I was working for NASA.
So you know the early history of it.
I was there.
You were the early history of it.
I was there. I was working on space station systems engineering and logistics, and we wanted to know what was being developed in this domain of small sats. And so one of the things that I did once or twice was go out to that conference to find out, what are these people doing?
It is radically different today.
Yep.
It reflects the industry that you've been describing for the last 50 minutes. It's an amazing change. And we need to pause. We're a little beyond the halfway point. So, listeners, we're going to take a pause for our intermission, so to speak. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with Gary and more about this and some other topics as well. For those of you that are able to access your phone, and you're not locked into being at work, that number is 1-866-687-7223. And emails can continue to come in. drspace@thespaceshow.com. Again, back in 3 minutes, everybody. Don't go anyplace.
This is with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Monday Space Show program. We have two sponsors with us for this second segment. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is the world's largest Aerospace Professional Society, and they have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries with over 95 corporate members, and they are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, and increasing our knowledge of the universe, as well as bringing the world closer together. Lots more information for this fine organization at www.aiaa.org. And also Celestis, the premier space memorial service or burial service, is a sponsor for this segment. And they really have interesting historical stories as their PR message that they like me to read. This one is called A Shooting Star in Final Tribute. In June 2012, Celestis' latest memorial spaceflight, carrying the ashes of 320 people in Earth orbit, re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, blazing like a shooting star in final tribute to those on board. The flight began earlier that year with a dramatic nighttime liftoff from Cape Canaveral, the launch location of Celestis' next orbiting mission, currently scheduled for liftoff later this year. The people on the 2012 flight included Mercury 7 astronaut Gordy Cooper, Star Trek actor Scotty or James Doohan, and hundreds of people from various walks of life all around the world. While the 2012 mission orbited a little over a month, Celestis's next Earth orbit mission is designed to orbit our planet for 5 years, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting Earth. Space on board is limited, so contact Celestis today to make sure your loved one can be a shooting star. I know it's really, I shouldn't say it, but I keep thinking the message is going to say, so hurry up and die so you can be on board the flight. But that isn't what they say. But as a customer of Celestis, I can attest to all of you that it is really a well-run organization, an excellent business with really wonderful people at the helm. So it is a great way to pay tribute to a loved one who cared about space. And Gary, we have an email question to start off the second period from Sweden with our friend Bijan. Do you see how swarms of small sats in LEO with global coverage could become competitive if they require individual launchers? Do they have a chance against reusable solar-powered drones or tethered balloons, which cover the commercially most interesting locations on Earth from above and more nearby? Best regards, Bijan.
That's another good question. It's actually one that I not so much address as bring up in the paper. It's going to be a market-by-market contest between the drones and the satellites. Where you have the infrastructure to run the drones, they're going to be highly competitive. The great advantage of the satellites is that they can cover the entire Earth, including parts of the Earth that really don't have the infrastructure to support the drones. And I think there are going to be cases where the satellites and the drones will, in fact, complement each other. The satellites will do broad area analysis of the of what's going on the ground, and then the drones will provide a cost-effective way of going in and collecting details that the broad area doesn't pick up. So I think that's going to be a very lively competition between those two industries for some time to come.
Jack is in Dallas. I just got in another question. He says, David, I'm also at work. My question is, I don't understand how you say the small sats can cover the Earth while the big satellites can't. The big satellites are much higher up, so they have a much bigger view. Why can't they cover the Earth once a day?
They can't cover the Earth once a day because two things. One is there aren't enough of them. And the other is that their field of view is very narrow. The large satellites tend to specialize in very high-resolution images. And in the process of getting that very high resolution, they get only a very small area at a time. They can give up some of that resolution and take area coverage. but they're still faced with the fact that there's only a few of them, and they don't go ever over the entire Earth every day. They just, there aren't enough of them. So if you want to cover the entire Earth, you need a larger number, and the large numbers you can't get at the cost level of the very large satellites, so you have to go down in size.
How many CubeSats does it take to cover the Earth? What kind of swarm are you talking about?
Well, that's really interesting. For Planet Labs and their design, they're talking about, let me see now, 150, I believe was their number, to cover the Earth. And on the other hand, another company called OmniEarth proposes with a different design to cover the entire Earth with 18 satellites.
Wow.
So, but obviously, with 18 satellites, you've got a different design, and you're taking much larger sweeps than the Planet Labs would. And somewhat in between them, Black Sky Global is proposing to collect, I think, around 40% of the Earth with 60 satellites. But each of those are possibly focused on different markets.
What is a typical ground station requirement for these small satellites that if you're going to try to cover the Earth? Do they need elaborate ground stations? Do they just need an SUV with some equipment in the back seat? I mean, what do they need?
I think something in between. Not too familiar with the ground station situation. I know that Planet Labs has built or is building around 12 ground stations, and their approach would be to store images, and as soon as each of their satellites comes within range of a ground station, to dump what they've stored through the ground station.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's fairly typical.
They don't have any bandwidth issues. They're in LEO, so that's not an issue for them?
I quite frankly don't know. I presume that they're going to design ground stations to fit the load.
Maybe someone does know if there are bandwidth constraints in LEO. I know there are when you get outside of LEO. It's a whole different ballgame.
I think it's worth mentioning that one of the lines of development that's very active right now is in laser communications. And laser communications offers much improved ground width. I mean, bandwidth.
Bandwidth.
Ground width. Much improved bandwidth and also lower power and typically lighter
equipment.
So there's a lot of advantages to it once people master the art. Of course, one of the disadvantages is that the lasers don't penetrate clouds, so you've got to deal with that issue.
You may remember this, but about 3 years ago, maybe it was 4 years ago, at one of the new space conferences in Silicon Valley, in the business plan competition, there was a company that was putting up a swarm, and I think they've done it, and they've changed the name of their company, and I'm having a mental block. But they were controlling their CubeSats with smartphones as their ground station units. And I think it was Peter Plotz, or God, who am I? Do you remember who I'm talking about?
I don't think I heard that one. I think I would have remembered it.
He did not win the business plan competition, but he went on to start his company, which I think at the time became very successful. Peter Plotner, I can't believe I'm having
the name is familiar.
The name of the company got another name. They changed the name of the company, but that their ground station was a smartphone.
Yes, you mentioned the business plan competitions that the New Space Conference hosted. I remember one particular incident where a company had come up with an idea for increasing human resistance to ionizing radiation through a biochemical
They've been on my show from that presentation multiple times. That is an incredible technology that they're developing.
But what I remember is that they came in just out of the money in the business plan competition, but they were immediately approached by people who were interested in helping them get started.
Yeah, their product, the guy, both the woman who was the scientist who presented, and she's no longer with the company, she moved on, and the owner of the company had been guest on the space show, and they were actually presenting this medication or pill for first responders in a bioterrorist nuclear attack, and how to protect first responders from any kind of enhanced radiation. But he was really interested in space, which is why he decided to present at the New Space Conference, which he found out about. And they thought there might be some protective capabilities against different kinds of radiation on a longer space mission. All of which, of course, to be tested and determined and studied and all of that. But it's a really interesting product. I haven't talked to them for about 2 years, but that was a great opportunity. Absolutely, they didn't win, but they did win. Which, New Space, with the business plan as an example, was way ahead of the times of everything else that I can think of, other than maybe the SmallSat conference. So would you concur with that? And I know you're on the board, so of course you probably concur to that. But what is the approach for New Space for the conference now and for the Space Frontier Foundation now that so many of their goals are actually happening? Are they changing the focus or the fight of what they're going for and their goals, or are they trying to speed up? How do you see what they're doing now, given the successes that are happening?
Before I answer that question, can I point out that the New Space Conference is just 2 weeks from now?
Yeah, of course, point it out. Uh-huh.
And I wanted to tell the listeners that we want to renew the offer of a special discount code for the Space Show listeners. And what it means is you'll get the early bird rate for the conference registration, even though early bird registration closed a long time ago. And the discount code for the listeners is SPACESHOW16.
All one word, right?
All one word, SPACESHOW16. And this is going to be, I think, one of the more interesting New Space conferences that we've ever had. We're in a new location, Seattle, and we're drawing a different set of companies than we've drawn before. And because Seattle is a newly emerging hotbed of space development. And also, now getting back to your question, we are in fact shifting our focus with this conference in how we help support the entrepreneurs and their investors. In the past, the New Space Conference, and I should mention also, before the New Space Conferences, there were the Space Frontier Conferences.
Right.
Going back decades, and all of them have been a center for investors and entrepreneurs and the entrepreneurs' customers as well, to get together and meet and network and begin the deal-making process and sometimes conclude the deal-making process. And that has always gone on. But we're taking it to a new level now because we perceive that, as I mentioned before, the focus of the industry is shifting a bit beyond the creation of new enterprises towards the nurturing and sustainment and growth of enterprises. And in order to help that, we've created a new venture lab, which will be announced at the New Space Conference. And it includes a concierge service, which I think of as sort of a matchmaking service between companies and investors. before the networking was somewhat catch as catch can. We're helping sort of organize that, make it more likely that the right investors and the right companies will get a chance to talk with each other. So it's, I think it's going to be a really exciting mix this year.
Is there a lot of political lobbying that the foundation does, or is it working sort of, this is all going to happen separate from government?
There's a certain amount of lobbying involved always with the foundation, not directly all the time, somewhat indirectly at times. The foundation is a co-founder of the Alliance for Space Development, where I'm also on the board, and that is a coordinating body of 12 different nonprofits that go together to communicate with Capitol Hill. And we've had some significant success in our first year out. This is, we're really completing our first year recently. And we've set up measurable goals each year, and then we have a report card that reports on how we did the previous year, and there's a Alliance for Space Development website out there that you can find, and you can check out our report card on how we did last year. We supported things like full funding for the commercial crew program and certain regulatory developments in Washington and that sort of thing.
If you were to rewrite your Space Review article in 5 years and 10 years, what do you think would be different?
5 years and 10 years. What will be different is we'll actually know what happened. Right now, we're at such the beginning point. We've been, those of us that follow the industry have seen this coming for at least a few years now. It's breaking on the rest of the world rather more suddenly. But we've seen it coming for a few years, and I think sometimes we don't appreciate how much we're just at the stepping off point. I mean, for example, of all the new, perhaps 20 dedicated small sat launchers that people say they are developing, only one has actually had a test launch, and that one failed. And the really interesting ones, the low cost ones, not one of them has had their first test launch. Now they are several of them scheduled within the next year or two to have their first launches. So, certainly within 5 years, we will know how that all shook out. And it'll be very interesting to see which ones succeed, which ones fail. But I think the important point is that which one succeeds and which one fails doesn't matter as much as that some of them will succeed because the demand is there. If some fail, other people will step up to meet the demand. As long as the demand is there, somebody will step up to supply it.
So that's one area where it would change. Do you think the satellite industry will continue to show growth?
I think so. But here's one of the things that I don't think people have thought about yet, and that is that many of the more traditional companies won't, and for that matter government agencies, won't really take small sat seriously, and they certainly won't take small sat launchers seriously until they actually see them flying and producing results. So once that happens, I would expect a second wave of interest in the small sats and in the dedicated launchers as people who were adopting a wait-and-see attitude find their doubts resolved one way or the other, and they're now ready to take it seriously and begin looking at new missions and new markets.
10 years out, what do you think?
10 years out, well, I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Esther Dyson about the future. She says, I could give you a good idea about 2 years from now, and I think I have a fairly clear idea about 50 years from now. In between, it's a complete fog. I think I'll stand with Esther on 10 years out.
So 10 years is a complete fog.
10 years is pretty much a complete fog. This whole thing could not pan out if people aren't able to solve the problems. Or we could be looking at an explosive new industry with the total revenue in the tens of billions a year, possibly even hundreds of billions a year within 10 years.
So are there a couple of key triggers that you would be looking for to determine if this is going to pan out or not pan out?
Well, on the launcher side, they simply have to launch, and the launches have to work. That's pretty cut and dried.
Right.
On the satellite side, you still have to build the satellites and get them launched. But then the real challenge I see there is first what we talked about before, the value propositions. You have to find what it is you're going to offer to really big markets, because the pattern of this is clear, that the best way to succeed in space is to get a small percentage of a really huge market. And that was the pattern with satellite telecommunications, the traditional winner of space commerce so far, and it's three-quarters of the global space industry is satellite telecommunications, and yet that whole industry is only 4% of total global telecommunications. Global telecommunications is $5 billion a year, and the satellite portion is about $200 billion a year. But that $200-some billion is three-quarters of the entire global space industry, and it's three times all of the government expenditures put together. So I see that as the pattern that will be followed in the near future as well, where space enterprises find a way to address huge markets and get their small piece of the action, you will see huge growth. But they have to do it, and they have to be able to distribute it. We talked about that as well, which is you have to be able to get the information to the end user in a form that the end user can use and have the end user have the ability to use it. So if the information is good to help you with fertilization or irrigation or whatever, then the farmer needs to have the ability to do those things, to actually make use of the information. So I think that there's going to be a growth of information wholesalers and retailers that will need to grow out from the space enterprises. In the case of telecommunications, it'll be a lot easier. Some of the new enterprises propose to deliver internet service directly from space, and in that case, of course, they have the advantage of dealing with an internet that already exists. They're providing a new outlet for it.
Listeners, there is still time if you do have access and want to use your phone, 1-866-687-7223, and we can continue taking your questions for a few more minutes. Todd is in San Diego, California, and Todd says you have skipped over, although these are not necessarily commercial space projects or missions, the entire planetary science field, as well as human spaceflight. Do you see any commercial money-making opportunities or links into planetary science missions and possibly human spaceflight coming up down the road?
Yes, I'm glad that that's brought up, because I think that commercial space stations may well be one of the great new breakout industries that's just getting started now, and the opportunities there are really unexplored. I think one of the core industries to be developed there is in biomedical research. Space station has shown that a number of things is possible, but the space station itself is so limited in a number of ways that they can't really develop it on the space station. The major limitation is that they just don't have enough crew members there to do as much research as would really be needed. Another thing is that the biomedical researchers in particular require what amounts to a parcel service. They need frequent small mass transportation, both up and down, but especially down, to get their samples back to labs on the ground. And that simply has not been available. And they need other things as well. They need proper communication support and a number of other important things. But commercial space stations that are responsive to the market could develop that. And that's a domain that is there to be explored. We mentioned tourism. I think there are many other opportunities in space. One of the things that the Alliance supported a year ago, we had a press conference about some grant-funded research that was done, grant-funded by NASA, on going to the moon and mining water as a commercial enterprise at the lunar poles, shipping the product into space and using the water broken down into hydrogen and oxygen as fuel for Mars missions. This was not a proposal. This was an exploratory analysis to see what kind of architectures might make sense and find out whether they made cost sense. And it turns out that they made tremendous cost sense, potentially. And there was a lot of discussion about that since then. So commercial development of lunar resources, commercial development of asteroid resources, and having the reduced costs then enable expanded space science going forward.
So the planetary missions would benefit by reduced cost, and therefore you could do more for less.
That is correct. Personally, I see commercial development of space as a critical path for major human space flight in the future. We have to bring the cost down and reliability up. And if you take a look at any of the successful space ventures, whether they be small sats or launcher vehicles, SpaceX in particular, what you see is a pattern of increased reliability paired with lower cost. It's not an either or. You get both.
You have another question from Sweden, again from Bijan, maybe our last one of the day. We'll see. Elon Musk companies seem to all be focused on Mars technology, solar power, batteries, vacuum engineering, like the Hyperloop, besides SpaceX. Do you think so too, and that also such activities on Earth should be counted as investments in space?
Counted as investments in space?
That's what he said.
I'm not sure it really matters how we account it. I think it matters what we do. What Elon is doing is not just focused on Mars. He's focused on the whole energy economy of the Earth. So his giant battery factory will, as I understand it, supply both his Tesla electric cars and his Solar City residential solar power systems. It all goes together. One of the potential ventures that's still out there, we're waiting to see the numbers get closer to closing economically, but there's still the idea of solar power satellites providing electric power to the Earth. That idea is still there. People are still watching it. We're looking at the economics get closer to closing as time goes on. If those numbers actually do close, then that's an entire new industry on top of all the others. And the more industries you have going, the more traffic, the lower the costs, the higher the reliability, and the more that people are capable of doing.
We're coming up toward the last couple of minutes of the program. Do you have any pearls of wisdom for us on this topic, or summary statements, or takeaway points you want us to hold on to?
Go ahead. I think the takeaway is that there are markets available for space to address, and that they are large markets. Tourism, I'll return to that briefly, is a $1.25 trillion a year industry. If space were to get a 1% share of that, that would be over $10 billion a year. Half of that would still be over $5 billion a year. Actually over six. That's enough to provide a nice support for an enterprise of commercial space stations. I think that there's, I didn't mention before the prestige, the national prestige market. I think there are many countries on Earth that would like to have an astronaut program, a human space flight program. They cannot afford it now, but with Boeing and SpaceX providing space transportation, and Bigelow and whoever steps up to compete with Bigelow providing the space stations, then those nations will be able to step in and have a human space flight program that they can't afford now.
Do you see the drive on all of this to continue attracting students in graduate school into, say, the STEM topics, also coming from other countries? Do you think that this is going to make space pretty competitive with other consumer engineering opportunities like Apple Computer, for example, or Google or others that typically have done better than, say, NASA and space, because they actually get to see their projects developed within a year or two, whereas space has been traditionally very long-term?
In the last couple of years, I've gotten to know a lot more of the young people moving into the industry. And as far as I can see, it already has a powerful draw on people. And I certainly don't think that any of the new space companies have any shortage of applicants for the available jobs. I think the excitement has always been there. Now they've got a place to apply it.
Probably not. Somebody was talking on the space show the other day about the layoffs that have been taking place at X-Corp, and they said they didn't think that they would be out of work very long if they wanted to go back to work in the aerospace industry, that they would be taken up by other companies fairly quickly.
I'm glad to hear that. And some of those people are friends of mine.
And I'm assuming that I don't have any solid information on that, but I'm assuming that that's probably a pretty correct statement, that those 25 people or so can and will be absorbed by a lot of growth in the industry. I mean, every time I meet people from some of these south of market space companies, their face has completely changed. I mean, it's just like you can't keep track of the new people involved and the growth. And I'll get emails from people that say, I'm now doing this and this, and we want to talk to you about a space show program. And the person I talked to a year ago has moved on and is doing something else. And there just seems to be no shortage in the pipeline of people coming into these companies.
Well, there's certainly a lot of new money coming in. I mean, I think one of the great signs was when Google bought Skybox.
And why did they change the name of that? What do you know the history of that and why they repositioned the company, what they're planning to do?
I don't know why they renamed it. I know what they said about what they're doing, and it's fascinating. They are taking the images from Skybox, and they are integrating it with all the geolocated data that they have from all of their other myriad data sources. If you think of Google, you can imagine what they have available in the way of geolocated data, everything from cell phone densities to, I don't know.
Who knows?
But the point is, what they're doing is amounts to multi-end integration. You know, integration across the whole sphere of geolocated data. And so that's one approach to getting what you might call a value-added analysis product that will help people make better decisions. Another approach to that is sort of at right angles to it. There's an outfit in Africa that's set up a thing called the African Satellite Constellation. And it's not a satellite constellation at all. Actually, what it is, it's a service that integrates images from 13 different satellite systems run by, I think, 7 different companies, with the idea that they would deliver some kind of an image of any particular spot in Africa once a day from something.
And they can sell that data. There are customers to buy that data.
Well, that will be the rest of the business. Merging the information may turn out to be the easy part.
Getting the paying customers may be the other. Well, there's going to be a future for you to update this article every year or two. You know that, of course, right?
I understand that.
This is you've got built-in rejuvenation for continuing to do this.
Actually, I want to write a follow-on note just about the logistic S-curve side of things, the time dimension of this. But that's for a future show.
Okay, well, when you do it, let me know so I make sure I see it and be happy
Certainly.
To talk to you about it. I do want to thank you, number one, for writing the article. I think it's really fascinating. And listeners, if you have not read it, I really urge you to go to the Space Review and read it. And again, the links are in the email newsletter and the website newsletter, but I'll also put it in the archive summary of the program when I archive this program. And Gary, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to having you back on the show later on, and again to discuss some of these fascinating economic and engineering topics and watching how they impact one another. And I hope you have a great new space conference. Listeners, remember that code is all one word, Space Show 16. And there's a place for you to write the code in when you're registering for the conference at the New Space Conference. And I'll put the URL for the conference in the registration page in the summary as well.
And I should repeat that it's 2 weeks from now, June 21st, 23rd.
Okay. And listeners, thank you for your emails. And Gary, have a great week. And I will email you when I have this archived, probably early in the morning, California time.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. I look forward to another time.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it. Check the newsletters for programming for the balance of this week. And again, thank you for participating. Everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Good night from Gary, David, and the Space Show.